And now, another hour of the Motown Story with John Trenton.
WTMA, Charleston.
The sound of Motown Records. It's called the sound of young America, the Detroit sound. Born in 1959 by Berry Gordy Jr. with an idea, plenty of nerve, and $800 borrowed from his father. The Motown sound. Gordy Jr. from Detroit, Michigan, tried to make it up the ladder of success via the boxing ring. He knocked around in the ring, the Army, an unsuccessful record shop of his own, and the Ford automobile assembly line. He left his job on the assembly line and set up an unglamorous recording studio in a rundown part of western Detroit and an apartment between funeral homes. And what has happened since that time in 1959 is nothing short of sensational. Gordy now runs the most successful singles record business in existence today. Gordy built his empire from a thought, hope, and know-how through sound and engineering and the magic touch of a Berry Gordy hit record. A sound like none other in the world of pop music. It wasn't easy, and it certainly wasn't instant success. Gordy says, frankly, "I have great respect for company presidents. I stumbled into being one." Gordy, like nearly all of his performers, writers, and producers, was born and raised in Detroit's Negro District. Rock and roll has become everyone's music, but the sound came out of the Negro slums, and nobody knows how to profit from it better than Gordy. Detroit is now recognized as one of the major music outlets of the world. If a record carries the Motown label, it's assured of careful consideration by any DJ anywhere for airplay. Gordy closed a gap with his music. He gave the world music which everyone liked. Everyone who had rhythm, a feel for sensitivity. His music gained acceptance on top 40 radio stations across the country, but other rhythm and blues music just couldn't make it. Gordy bridged the gap, and this is one of the key reasons for the fantastic success of Motown Records. What's Gordy have to say about it? Listen.
Having been around a lot of the crowd coming from the ghetto and the blues-loving people and all that, you know, we really dug the type of things that reflected the society, and I felt that this was something that could be a very good force in American music and in communicating with people. I had always wanted to be a songwriter. I decided to write things more from feeling, because I wanted just a straight line approach with what I was trying to say to the people. When I would write the song and send it out, it would not come out like I thought it should. So I was unhappy with that, so I decided to produce my things. And then I got Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and we started producing. That was how the record company really got started. Of course, we did some foolish things. We put all our money in each year, and if we had gone any year without hit records, we'd have been out of business. We just turned it over and over and over and over, and after 5 years, we had at least 3 or 4 or 5 hits each year. Money was the first hit. At the time, I was broke. I had, you know, a girlfriend or two who were telling me, you know, how much they loved me, but meant nothing. Therefore, the line came that your love gives me such a thrill, but your love don't pay my bill.
Start strong and money. That's what I want. Barry probably didn't realize it, but this was the beginning. And money, plenty of it, was to be made by Motown. During this time, Gordy had begun to work with a young songwriter named William Robinson, known better as Smokey Robinson, who was one of the most talented young men in the rhythm and blues field. He wrote a new song called Shop Around, which he performed himself with a group called The Miracles. Released late in 1960, it became a hit. And by February of 1961, it had sold 1 million copies.
First of all, we got together as a group, the five members that we have now, in 1955 or 6, I believe. We were in high school. We sang at different local talent shows and so on and so forth. Shop Around was the third record that really made some noise for us nationally, but it was the biggest record that we ever had to that point, and the biggest record for Motown Records. It was the first million seller, and it really, really got things moving, you know. Shop Around was recorded in 1960, and early in 61, we got a gold record. It really got us established as a group.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
Around was just the beginning for Smokey and the Miracles. Much more was in the making. Smokey was writing songs of love.
I don't know. I guess my mind is just oriented towards that type of thought, or sad songs dealing with love. I think more people identify with these type of songs. You can start singing a happy song and it strikes a groove, you know, it'll strike a groove and people get happy and everything, but the sad songs get the reaction.
More talent was being uncovered. More hit records were being turned out. Now, by the Marvelettes.
We became involved with Motown really through a talent show that we had in school. And we were supposed to be auditioned by someone from the company. And that's how really it all got started. We worked mainly on the weekends because all of us were still in school, you know, and we didn't want to miss out on school too much, but we got a tutor to go with us so we could get our high school diplomas. I really enjoy Pleasing Mr. Postman because I think to a lot of people, say for instance, like servicemen in particular, I imagine that there's quite a few fellas that don't get mail, and this is a thing, I think that might be one of the reasons that it really clicked the way it did, because maybe their wife or their girlfriend hadn't gotten a letter from them, or say for instance, like college fellas, if they're gone away or their girlfriends are gone away, they're looking for this letter for them, you know, sense of security.
Oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman, wait, hey, hey.
Written by Gladys Horton, one of the girls in the group. She had mainly written it, but, you know, of course, like, the stories have to be rather strong to be able to do anything, you know. So, of course, like, they changed it and brought it up to date and all like that. And that's how we got that to.
Oh,
Motown was now turning out the hits, but on the business side, it had problems. Motown had to rely on small distributors to get their records to retailers. Some of their distributors got carried away by success and overextended themselves as they tried to expand their staffs to handle the new volume. Motown tried to collect. Distributors were often out of money. Collecting wasn't easy. Then one of Gordy's sisters took over the management of collecting, and she managed to get enough money to keep the company on its feet. Then a fellow by the name of Marvin Gaye came to Motown.
I started out in gospel. My father, of course, was minister, and I of course, sang in the church, and I played drums for most of the acts in the early 60s because I needed money. And I always thought I wanted to be a singer. I still want to be a great singer or become that. Stubborn kind of fellow. That's an interesting thing because I had written a jazz kind of thing on that, and Berry Gordy was in the control room at the time, and he was listening to it, and then he said, well, now let's change a few chords, and we changed a few chords, and he said, well, now it sounds pop, man. Now I think we can get some record sales out of it.
Mr. Marvin Gaye and a stubborn kind of fella. Marvin Gaye was destined to become one of Motown's biggest stars. And one of his next big hits, he wrote himself, Pride and Joy.
I don't know what ever prompted me to write a song entitled Pride and Joy. I imagine my wife had something to do with it. I was very much in love, I think, at that time with my wife. And that's why I wrote it, I think. And when I recorded it, I was thinking of it very much.
destroyed. You pick me up.
Pick me up
when I'm down.
When I'm down.
And when we go out early, baby, you shake up the whole town. And that's why I believe you're mine.
Ride
and joy.
Ride
and
joy.
Yeah.
Marvin Gaye and Pride and Joy. Stevie Wonder, Motown's multi-talented superstar, is convincing when he says a handicap isn't a handicap unless you make it one. Stevie ranks as a top-selling recording artist, and it's standing room only when his name appears on a concert bill. He was discovered by one of the Miracles, who arranged for 12-year-old Stevie to audition for Berry Gordy. Gordy was astounded by his talent, and in spite of his youth, was signed by Motown.
I started singing professionally at the age of 9, ever since I could holler, really. I did a lot of listening to the radio, so I listened to a variety of kinds of music. I've always admired the gospel music, some classical music. I've listened to all of the pop artists and R&B people. I was discovered by Ronnie White, who sings with the Miracles. Ronnie auditioned me. The following day, I was called to come down for an interview, an audition with Berry Gordy. My first biggest record was Fingertips.
Stevie Wonder and Fingertips. By now, talented Detroit youngsters were flocking to Motown studios for auditions. One of the many, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. The original Vandellas, Martha Reeves, Rosalind Ashford, and Annette Beard, had been singing for YMCA functions, church socials, and birthday parties. They attended Detroit's Northeastern High School together, rehearsing after school, singing for fun, but having their dreams of stardom. Martha Reeves talks of her early days at Motown.
Upon graduating from high school, I had had a little bit of experience in singing, but didn't know what would be my livelihood, didn't know what I'd make a career of, because, well, everybody's kind of quite like in question about what their future is going to be when they're 17, 18 years old. And I worked at a few jobs. I think I was a telephone solicitor, and I was a clerk at a cleaner's, and all kinds of things. So I came over to Motown with a group called the Delphi's, which, you know, never really made it. And we were told at that time that they weren't taking any more auditions, and just don't call them, they'll call us. Motown was the biggest thing in Detroit. I wanted to belong and be a part of, and decided just to be a secretary. One of my jobs were making promos for different artists, and I happened to make one for Mary Wells, who didn't show up for a session, luckily for me, because they took the track, and it was our first release called I'll Have to Let Him Go, which didn't sell but about 3 copies, and I think we bought all 3 of them. Right after that, we got Coming at These Memories, and from then on, it's been top 20, top 10, and we got kind of spoiled.
Love you,
it was cut, I think, in 64. It was when, I think, the Charleston sound was trying to be revised. It has a beat similar to the Charleston, which is also similar to Quicksand. We got in kind of the same kind of a groove with those two particular records. The thrilling thing about Heatwave was the fact that while it was number 10 across the nation, I think, there was a Heatwave in Los Angeles, and they used it as a news spot.
Thank you.
The second of many, many hit records for Martha and the Vandellas, Heat Wave. Smokey Robinson wrote Motown's first million seller, Shop Around. Smokey continued to write hit records, and he became Motown's most prolific writer of hit tunes. Born in Detroit, Smokey attended Dwyer Elementary and Northern High School. Along with his special music talents, he also excelled in football and basketball. It was while Smokey was in school that he formed the Miracles with Ronnie White, Bobby Rogers, Pete Moore, and Claudette Rogers, who later became Mrs. Smokey Robinson. Smokey recalls how Mickey's Monkey became a hit.
I heard this guy, Lamont Dozier, he was fiddling around with it on the piano, you know. I liked the thing that he was doing. He was just doing the Lumdy Lumdy Live because he hadn't really gotten it together, you know. And I asked him to record it on us because I thought it was a good... just that part there was strong.
All right, is everybody ready?
Yeah!
Yeah! All right, now here we go. I want to... Yeah.
Miss Mary Wells, and you beat me to the punch. Marvin Gaye had been singing all of his life, first in the church choirs in his native city of Washington, D.C. Marv took part in every possible school program there was. He said he just couldn't stand to be left out of a school music program. After high school, Marv joined the Air Force and did a lot of singing on the bases. He was stationed in Texas, Kansas, and in Wyoming. After discharge, he returned east and joined a vocal group called the Moonglows. Marv wanted to sing alone, and of course he left the group. Marv's first two successes for Motown you've already heard, Stubborn Kind of Fellow and Pride and Joy. Marvin said he had been influenced by a number of singers, including Ray Charles and Billie Holiday. Marv said he liked singers that made him sad. Marvin was to meet three fellows who would make him very happy with a new song.
Holland Dozier and Holland came to me one day, and they said, "Gee, Marv, we've got a great thing here." And I said, "Well, gee, I need something, you know." Diane and a couple of the other Supremes were in the studio, and they said, "Well, let's use them for backup voices." And so Diane thought it was great. She loves that kind of thing. She's so groovy. And she said, "Yeah, I'd love to get on that." And so Diane and the girls did background work on that. And I went in and recorded. I said, "Gee, man, I love it so much." I just went right in that afternoon and did Can I Get a Witness?
About this time, three girls found their way to Motown Studios in Detroit. They were eventually to be named the Supremes, and their story wasn't an instant rise to fame. They went to Motown while they were still in high school, only to be told they were too young to be part of the company. When they were signed to a contract, success came slowly. One of their releases was called Buttered Popcorn, but they found out it was hard to get airplay because no one had heard of the Supremes. It did get play on several R&B stations to help get their name in front of the public, and the record made the Billboard charts, the music industry's measure of hit status. Their third release, Breathtaking Guy, appeared like a shoe-in for a hit. However, it didn't really make it. Then their break, When the Love Light Shines in His Eyes. This record established the Supremes as a top female recording act. Diana Ross talks about the early days at Motown.
I moved to a street on the north side of Detroit, and Smokey lived about 4 or 5 doors away from me. And to know that Smokey Robinson lived down the street from me, it thrilled me to no end. And I used to sit and watch them rehearse on their basement steps. And I told him that I had a group. You know, if at any time that he could listen to my group, I would really appreciate it. And he did set up an audition for us to go to Motown. And the only reason Barry saw us or heard us is because he happened to be passing through the studio at the time we were singing. Finally, after meeting Barry and trying to get a contract with the company, they decided that they might sign us if we go back and finish high school. Like, I was about in 11th grade. I needed a job, really, to help my family out and also to get me car fare enough to get back and forth to the studio to try to do some background sessions. And he gave me a job, and it was about 3 months I worked there. I didn't do a thing except straighten off his desk, you know, try to straighten the papers. But it wasn't a real office anyway, because at that time, Barry used the whole building for working, and everybody kind of gathered in this room. They had a dart board. I know the Miracles used to come in there and throw darts at the dart board. That was a big thing. Everybody would bet money on who could get closest to the center mark. And so it was just a lot of fun at that time. It wasn't really work. But I only worked the summer, and I think he paid me like about $20. I gave up many times. In fact, every time I got to the end of my road, something nice would happen, and I end up singing again. But our first recording, we recorded Where Did I Love Go? Everybody liked it so much because they said it was a very sexy-sounding, young sound. And it was a nice song because it was melodic. And it just repeated, baby, baby.
Baby, baby. Baby, don't leave me. Oh, please don't leave me. All by myself. I've got this burning, burning, yearning. Feeling inside me. Ooh, deep inside me. And it hurts so bad.
The Supremes and Where Did Our Love Go? Their first number one record. The Supremes are perhaps the best example of what Tamla Motown represents. Success, sound, love of work, and class. The last of these items is not the easiest asset to come by, and Diana Ross, lead singer for The Supremes, explains everyone with a family has to go to class. A finishing school for beauty and charm, a choreography class, and a vocal class. Everyone goes, even if they don't have to sing or dance. They have to learn these different aspects of the business to improve their stage presence. It's not just automatic. It's all part of the amazing Barry Gordy treatment. More about the Supremes.
The Temptations, well, they're now known as the Temptations. They were the Primes, and this was in 1959. They wanted a girls group to sing with them, not as a whole group, but as a separate group. So they went around the neighborhood, which we were living in at the time, projects, and they were just asking girls if they would like to sing. So it wasn't very hard because everyone was standing on street corners singing. The Temptations rehearsed with us for hours and hours and hours trying to get it all together. And so they said, well, now we better get a name for you. And in those days, everything was the Etz. So they said, well, why don't you call yourselves the Primettes? And we said, great, great, you know, that sounds great. So we were the Primes and the Primettes. Baby Love is still my favorite record. It was our most popular. Everyone was singing, Baby Love, Baby Love.
There was no stopping them now. The Supremes were flying high, and their third number one record in a row was playing on top 40 stations across the country.
Won't you hurry?
With the establishment of the Supremes as a supergroup and real moneymakers, they now set out to polish their act for personal performances. Of course, many great things were still to come for the Supremes, and we'll be covering it all. Rock and roll was now called by many as an assault on one's eardrums. It's become today's most cultural phenom. Rock and roll, the music that emerged in the early 50s with a booming beat, clanging guitars, honking saxophones, and simple, if not sometime idiotic lyrics, has gone respectable. Once regarded by the adult world as yet another exasperating aberration of adolescence, it has now become the darling of the intellectuals and a communication link between generations. One of Motown's earlier groups was the Contours. They were never quite able to establish a consistent hit streak. They had several records that made some noise. However, their most successful record was a thing called Do You Love Me?
You broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake 'em down. Do you love me?
Of the Contours, and it's called Do You Love Me? In 1963, Motown's gross climbed to a multi-million dollar figure, with close to 80% of this dollar volume in sales attributed to single hits. Even with a great volume, it was still a struggle to gain financial stability without restricting the creative freedom that would lead to Motown's tremendous growth. The Motortown Revue was inaugurated in 1963, which boosted Motown's presence in the album market with two review LPs and gave valuable public exposure to both developing acts and Motown's established stars. This was also the year that Motown opened a Hollywood office to handle A&R and publishing activities and established a West Coast base for talent recruiting and recording operations. Motown had now become the world's largest independent recording company, and they finished third in single record sales behind such established giants as RCA Victor and Columbia. Quite a remarkable effort. Martha Reeves talks now about the record Dancing in the Street, another very big moneymaker for Motown.
This was a very bad time all over the United States. We were just starting to have different
confusions in different cities, the riots and the what have you. And I think the writers were inspired mainly because of this, to try an effort to get people to dance and be happy in the street instead of the riots. And it was really a great record. I really feel that we were blessed just to have the privilege of singing that particular song.
Town Moneymakers, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, and Dancing in the Street. The growing popularity of rock and roll music stems partly from the emergence and acceptance of Negro culture growing out of the civil rights movement. The fact also that a generation has now grown up with this kind of music certainly has helped. Another of the early groups at Motown, the Four Tops, Levi Stubbs, Ronaldo Benson, Abdul Faker, and Lawrence Payton. All four were born and raised in Detroit, and began singing with local groups in high school. One night in 1954, a fateful circumstance brought the Four Tops together at the same party, where they began harmonizing almost spontaneously. The four became good friends and set out on the idea to become professionals. They signed a contract with an agency that booked them into small cabarets in and around Detroit and Cleveland. At first, they called themselves the Four Ames. They changed that to the Four Tops when they began making records. Here's the voice of Levi Stubbs.
The group Four Tops consists of Ronaldo Benson, Abdul Faker, better known as Duke, and Lawrence Payton, and myself, Levi Stubbs. We all were raised in the same neighborhood. We just came up on the corners, I imagine, like most groups did. You know, and 1963, we went to Mr. Gordy, and T liked what we had to offer, and we had known him for some time, you know, and he was aware of our talent. Baby, I Need Your Lovin', first of all, it was extremely relaxed kind of thing. We'd sit around and talk and maybe sing a line at a time and try to get a feeling for the tune and send out and get a sandwich or a cold beer and wait an hour till the sandwich settled. And then we'd take another shot at it, you know, and luckily for us, we came up with a pretty good move and cut it and came up with a smash.
Baby, I need your love. Baby, I need your love. 'cause I'm so lonely.
I Need Your Lovin', the beginning of the Four Tops' many hits and their valuable place in Motown's history. For adolescents, rock and roll has more relevance than any popular music of the past. And with this affluent group, enlarged by a growing number of appreciative adults, rock and roll certainly seemed here to stay, as long as any currently saleable commodity. Adults who used to hate the music now began to like it. Or should we say, dig it. Of course, a torrent of junk still flows daily from recording studios, but much of it is exciting, original, sensitive, and quite intelligent. Record sales soared. In 1954, record sales totaled $199 million. 10 years later, in 1964, sales had soared to over $800 million. Although those figures included sales of all recordings, classical, jazz, talk records, etc., pop music still had the biggest share of the overall gain. Driven by the idea that newer is better, the popular music market absorbs an enormous output of new product each year. In 1964, about 7,500 new singles, those were 45 RPM records, were released with, of course, a different performance on each side. This means that about 15,000 different pop music performances are competing for the attention of radio station disc jockeys. Naturally, frequent playing on the air is about the only way to build a demand for the product. However, competition is so great that even a record that catches on may come and go in just a matter of weeks. Let's listen to Marvin Gaye now as he relates about having almost a number one record.
Well, I was very happy with How Sweet It Is because I had nearly cracked the number one spot. I went to number five, and I remember that I hadn't had a record go that high in the charts previously. How Sweet It Is was my all-time favorite.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, baby. Ooh. How sweet it is to be loved by you. The shelter of someone's arms, and there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were. With sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions, I wanna stop and thank you, baby. I wanna stop and thank you, baby. Hey now, how sweet it is to be loved by you.
And wonder what would I be without you in my life. Everything was just a bore. All the things I did since I've done them before. But you brighten up, oh my babe, with a love so sweet in so many ways. I wanna stop and thank you, baby. I wanna stop and thank you, baby. Hey, how sweet it is to be loved by you. Oh, yes, it is, baby. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, it is, baby. Been to myself. For me, there's you and nobody else. Stop and thank you, baby. I wanna stop and thank you, baby.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. That, of course, Marvin Gaye. About the same time, a young lady by the name of Kim Weston had her first big hit for Motown, Take Me in Your Arms. Soon people all across America were singing along, Take Me in Your Arms, and Rock Me Just a Little While.
Take me in your arms, hold me for a little while.
Rock me a little while. Oh, darling, rock me a little while.